Hello and welcome to In Focus with Insight. My name is Pamela Hillig. I'm head of Insight Life Solutions. And today we have an episode of the Open Books series in which we get to know fascinating and inspiring people in the actuarial and insurance community through the books that they have read and loved. Today I'm joined by Darren Berendt. Darren is currently the CEO of Investec Life and he also heads up My Investments, which is Investec's high income client investment proposition. He actually started his career in academia. He completed a PhD in mathematics at UJ in 2005, and he also lectured for a few years. He joined Investec in 2006 and spent the next 12 years in the risk area in the capital markets division, building various treasury and lending businesses and conceptualizing businesses like Investec Life and Investec Specialist Investments. In 2018, he left Investec to spend some time co-founding, advising, and investing in early-stage financial services businesses, mainly in South Africa, Canada, and Europe. He always stayed connected to Investec Life, though, as a board director during those years, and he returned as CEO in 2022. Welcome, Darren.
Thank you very much.
So I'm so excited to be with you today because I've always been a huge fan of the Investec brand and, you know, we at Insight are huge fans of the Investec Life team. So really excited to get to know one of the people behind the organization a bit better. But first question is, are you a reader?
Yeah, so I've always been a reader. I think my habits have changed over time. So we can get a little bit into that. But from when I was a young kid, a lot of fiction stuff when I was a child. Mm. And then sort of as I finished school, it became a little bit more nonfiction. But yes, always been a reader.
So happy to hear that because this interview isn't like other podcasts you might have listened to in that we will get to know you and talk about what you're busy with and the work that you enjoy, but with the added angle of the books that have shaped you in some way. So you can think of it as the Desert Island Discs for bibliophiles. So before we get into the books, tell me what is keeping you busy these days?
Yeah, so I think you gave an intro. So before we talk professional life, got a young daughter. She's 11 months old. First one, we started very, very late. It's an adventure. She's a good sleeper, a good eater. She's a happy child. So we've been very, very lucky, but it is relentless. It's nonstop.
Do you read to her?
I do. She's got FOMO. So what I mean by that, if you carry her around, she wants to look everywhere. She is annoyed. She wants to see what's happening. When it comes to reading, she wants to grab the book and she wants to turn pages. So the reading often ends up being... we go through books very quickly, so we need a few of them at a time. But yeah, she enjoys her books. So hopefully that sticks with her, and see how that plays out over time.
Okay, and work-wise?
Oh yeah, sorry. So work-wise, yeah. So I think we've you spoke a little bit about what my focus is at the moment. So the way I think about it, if you think about Investec in the sort of private client and high income space, you know, we've always been very active in the banking space. And what we spent the last few years doing is effectively bringing the missing pieces to the market. So the one piece is financial advice for our private clients and high income clients. And then the two important pieces that I've been involved in, apart from the financial advisors, is then the investment product set and the life insurance product set. So, you know, as of probably in the last year, our private client high income proposition now includes access to banking expertise, access to financial advice, and then all the underlying pieces that you need, whether it's banking, life insurance, or the investments piece. So that's actually quite exciting. It's been a vision for a long time, but only in the first year have we actually now put all the pieces in place. And I think we've got quite a nice offering for our clients. And our philosophy and the focus on client experience extends and is consistent throughout. So that's takes the time. You know, it's very easy to launch product to clients, but how you do it and doing it in a way that's consistent with, I suppose, Investec's philosophy that's the piece where we've really had to work quite hard to solve. So yeah, so that's very busy. Like any new business, it's good to be live, it's good to be now growing. It keeps you busy.
And you've obviously been involved in Investec for a long time. How does, you know, I guess, servicing your banking clients and ensuring InvestSec's culture on the banking investment side differ from an insurance business?
Yeah, so that's actually quite interesting. So we'll talk a bit about it a bit later. One of my books has got a quote that alludes to this. So, I mean, the first thing to caveat is, and I don't know if this is a good or bad thing, but I don't have an insurance background. My first exposure to insurance has been in the context of InvestSec. So we started building out a business plan for the business in 2015, and we went live in 2017. So we're a relatively new business, and everything I've learned from, you know, through InvestSec life. When we started the business, I think it was quite interesting for us. I think when we looked at the market, we looked at how things worked in the market, there were certain dynamics that we thought, you know, we could do differently. In a way that is more consistent with the InvestSec way. And we thought that that would be good for clients. So things like more active engagement with clients, not necessarily providing them a solution and then, you know, not seeing them again for 15 years. Things like how the client experience works. So obviously the market's changed quite a bit in the last couple of years. But when we looked 7 years ago, it was still very admin intensive, paper-based application forms. So, you know, we were very early on, we embedded everything digitally into our app, into our online banking, you know, reflexive underwriting. So a client that's relatively young and healthy answers two or three questions, and the client that's got some kind of history is going to answer a few more questions, but, you know, very much a tailored solution for each.
So interested to hear more about that and, you know, what's next for InvestSec Life and how, you know, perhaps, as you say, the books have influenced your philosophy in some way. But before we get into the books, I have some questions on your reading habits. So how would you describe your relationship with reading and books?
Like, it's a bit of an obsession. No, I love books. I mean, again, if you ask my wife, maybe even my daughter, I think they would say that I spend too much time wanting to read. These days, I spend less time reading. We'll talk a bit about that. I mean, most of my reading is limited to evenings before bedtime, so I don't get through a lot. So the volume has become a lot less. But no, I love reading. I go through stages where some would say that I enjoy buying books more than actually reading the books, because I end up with a pile of 20 books. And I've tried to be a little bit more disciplined in the last few years and actually read the books that I've got. Your bookshelf starts getting quite full, and it's not a good thing if you've got a lot of books you've never read.
So you like a physical book rather than Kindle audio?
So I do get audiobooks. I'm not as good at finishing the audiobooks as I am at finishing physical books. My preference is still, you know, physical books. I do travel a fair amount for work, so it's quite nice from that perspective. You know, I enjoy podcasts, but sometimes, you know, there's nothing interesting, and then I'll have an audiobook. I can't get through an audiobook in a month, which is why I often don't finish them. You know, I get a new audiobook every single month, but my preference is definitely physical books where possible.
And are there any books that you love that haven't yet been made into a movie that you'd love to be seen made into a movie?
That's a hard one, only because there's so many books I love that have been made into movies. So, you know, we'll talk a little bit about Michael Lewis. I'm a massive Michael Lewis fan, and I think my favorite movies are actually the books that have been made into movies. So,
well, that's saying something about the movies, because usually the movies are a disappointment, eh?
Yeah, which hasn't been the case for me. And sometimes you read the book first and then you watch the movie, or sometimes you watch the movie. I've done both. So there's none of the ones specifically, you know, that I'd like to be, you know, made into a movie. There's a lot that have been made into movies, and I've loved those movies.
Okay, looking forward to hearing more about them. So yeah, let's talk about the first book or series of books.
I'm trying to think where to start. So maybe I'll start with something a little bit lighter. So let me grab this quickly. So this is a book called The 100-Year Life. I think it was written in 2015-ish. And again, I came across it probably by, you know, reading something on the FT or something along those lines. I can't remember, this needs to be fact checked, but the story I remember about this book, so it may or may not be true.
Why spoil a good story with the truth?
Yes, is that this actual book was originally launched in the West. It got very little traction. It somehow ended up being launched in Japanese in Japan, got massive amounts of traction, and then it was refound, if you can put it that way, in the West. So the interest grew again. So basically what it's about, and it's a relatively easy read, it's about the idea that if you think about our parents, sort of the cadence of their lives for the last 100 years has been pretty much consistent. You study for 20 to 25 years, you work for 40 years, you retire. Your retirement lasts 10 to 20 years. It's obviously becoming longer. So, you know, poor countries, richer countries, lifespans have increased by 2 years every 10 years for probably the last 100 years. So that's a consistent trend. So retirements have got slightly longer, but typically it's that 25, 40, 10 to 20, which meant that two things, I think. Number one, you could save during those 40 years of work to pay for your retirement. Mm-hmm. And number two is that the skills you developed in those first 25 years typically could last you for the next 40 years of work. So what this book talks about is it says, well, our lifespans, our longevity has changed. And we won't get into lifespan versus health span and all that kind of stuff. That's another interesting topic. But effectively, we are now going to, our generation is going to live to 100. And if you live to 100, if you work for, study for 25 years, you work for 40 years, you've got 35 years worth of retirement. You are not going to be able to retire for 35 years based upon what you've saved in 40 years. And in actual fact, the world is changing very quickly. So there's a question around whether your skills are going to continue to be relevant if you now have to work longer. Gosh, so they talk about how you should be thinking about savings. They talk about the fact that we're not going to retire at 65. What work looks like could be different. You know, like, again, for our parents and our parents' parents, it was very much you worked hard and then you stopped one day versus you work, your work changes, maybe it's a little bit more relaxing, you know, maybe it's got a bit more flexibility, whatever it is. So the nature of work, I think, will potentially change. We will need to work much longer to effectively pay for our retirements, and we would probably want to. You know, most people think, you know, living on a yacht for 35 years is fun, but I'm not sure if that's really true. And so it's really about how that's going to change and then how we're going to have to reskill ourselves on a periodic basis. So they talk in the book about, you know, every couple of years, you're going to have to go through a period of exploration. And that's around, that may result in you learning new skills. It may result in you, you know, materially changing your career. So I found this really fascinating. Like, I find this whole idea of lifespan, health span, quite interesting. And it's a very practical, easy to read book. So, and the ideas, like I said, I mean, they're relatively simple, but it was actually quite interesting, you know, just to think about the material impacts they're going to have on how our lives will evolve compared to, you know, the last few generations.
Has it impacted how you see your life playing out, or has it changed any of your plans yet?
Well, it was, I mean, in you spoke about it earlier. So I started my, I mean, people always say my first real job was Investec. I mean, it's not exactly correct. I did lecture. Okay. I was a full-time lecturer. I was an academic. It was a real job. But my first real job was Investec. And I was there for 12 years. And then in 2018, decided to just go and explore. So, yes, I think I read this book prior to that. And a bit of that was the exploration. You know, I actually wanted to spend some time outside of a big corporate. On a personal level, I'd been involved in a couple of startups, people I'd met locally and internationally, and I wanted to just have the capacity to understand what that's all about. And that's why, as you said, you know, I left with no plans. It was very much some of the businesses I was involved in. I went and spent some time on the ground. I spent some time in Canada with a business that was sort of at that inflection point between being a startup, 5-10 people in a room, to actually now having real clients and, you know, having to corporatize a bit. Spent some time advising, spent some time investing, started a little business with a co-founder in SA. So it was a period of exploration for me. And so even though there wasn't formal studies, I think the skills I learned there, like, have been invaluable when I've come back to Investec now in terms of my present role. It's changed the way I think about things. I've been lucky to be involved in building businesses my whole career at Investec, but it's changed the way I think about that. And I think for the better. I do think for the better.
What's one kind of tip or lesson that you can share?
So often I find that, especially if you work in a big organization, if you identify an opportunity, you want to build the Rolls Royce. You know, you sit down and you start and you say, and I think it comes down to materiality. So you have an interesting idea. You say, here's a new business opportunity. Mm-hmm. The immediate pressure is that this business opportunity is big, because otherwise it doesn't move the needle. If you're in a big organization, it's got to be big. And so you go down this rabbit hole, which involves you building a business plan, looking for investment, approval, resourcing to build, in actual fact, what is success in 20 years' time or 10 years' time. And that puts a massive amount of pressure when you actually start building, because your plans are never right. Like, whatever you start with, you've got to have the flexibility to tinker, to change direction, to, you know, rethink. And so that was the piece I learned. Like, that's very much the startup culture. You're not working. You're starting from scratch. You've got a blank piece of paper, a couple of people. You raise a little bit of money, you launch a product. You raise a little bit more money, you get a client. You raise a little bit more money, you get the next 5 clients. Like, you're not worried about 200,000 clients or 10 million clients. You're just worried about client number one. And then client number five. And that is quite strange in a corporate world because you're so busy focused on the end goal and you forget how important those steps are and how much uncertainty is in those steps. Mm. So that's, as an example, a practical example, you know, when I came back, there were certain things that we wanted to do and launch to our clients. And, you know, I came in and we said, we've got all the approvals. We're keen to do this. And the question was, well, when can we do it? Well, in 10 months' time. Why? Well, we've got to build it into this system and that system, and we've got to be able to handle all 100,000 private clients. And the question was, well, why not launch it to just 100 of our clients and see what happens? Do it manually, see what happens, see if there's appetite, are we on the right track? And that's very much something that I then learned outside dealing in a small business where you don't have the option, you have to do it like that. And yeah, it's proven, it has proven quite a useful way of thinking about things, even in, again, a big corporate.
So get that version one out and then, you know, pivot and improve and change as you need to rather than waiting until it's perfect to launch, right?
Most definitely. And it also takes the pressure off.
Yeah.
You know, when you go with the big plan and everybody signs off the big plan and they give you the resourcing for the big plan, you know, you start and you suddenly realize you've got something wrong. Like, you're married to it. And I think that's the biggest issue. At that point in time, it's so easy to, you know, effectively become unsuccessful and for it to fail because you're married to this big plan that everybody's bought into and nothing goes in a straight line. There is always going to be things you learn. You've got to be able to tinker. You've got to be able to change direction. That was very, very useful. And again, soft skills. I didn't study. It was just having exposure to the right. So triggered by this very simple, easy to read book.
But this book, you know, talks so much to my actuarial and insurance background because, you know, you do, from our studies from early on, you think about people need to plan now for 80 years time, either by investing or buying insurance or, you know, making sure they have enough savings. So has any of the philosophy in that book influenced Investec Life's culture or philosophy?
Definitely. So I think what we actually were having a conversation this morning, so it's quite interesting. So that's actually a very good question. So when I spoke earlier that, you know, we've now in the process where all of our clients have access to banking, investments, and life insurance. Mm-hmm. And our focus up to this point has been making sure we have the right proposition from a life insurance perspective and an investments perspective. The next phase for us is how you bring these things together. So a good financial advisor is able to bring it together, but there's a massive amount of value if you can, in actual fact, create products that bring those two pieces together. And so that's now the next phase for us to think about. We've solved the individual pieces. And to your point, you know, if people are now going to live longer, if their retirement needs are going to look different, you know, if people are going to, it's not just our clients, it's our clients' families.
Yeah.
So if our clients' families are going to live longer, they need to think about how they provide for their clients, both in terms of, you know, what they save or what they invest, but also then in terms of being appropriately covered from a life insurance perspective. So, you know, if we can bring those things together in the context of how our lives and the cadence of our lives is going to look different, I think that's very interesting. So I think the short answer is yes, but we're starting that process now.
Okay, what's the next book we're going to talk about?
So I think we must go a little deeper now. So this is not one book, it's a series of books. And I think it's quite popular with people in our industry and in the broader financial services. So it's effectively the four books. I've only got three of them here, my other copies in Johannesburg, of Nassim Taleb's books. So Fooled by Randomness, Black Swan, Anti-Fragile, and Skin in the Game. And there's some of these that I enjoy more, but I brought all of them because they sort of, there's a story that evolves through them. I also quite enjoy his writing style. So you asked earlier about, like, I like the story, but I'm very interested by writing styles and very different writing styles. So some people find his writing style, like, quite abrasive. I don't know if some people would be necessarily friends with him, but I find...
He's not looking for friends.
I personally find it entertaining. It's a very specific type of style, and a lot of his, again, because of my background, I think some of his ideas did resonate a little bit. So I don't know if we need to go through, you know, sort of what each of them are about. We can cover off sort of the key ideas. Otherwise, we can jump into a couple of quotes.
Yeah, tell me which ideas stood out for you, you know, throughout the whole
trend. I'll talk. So the first book, which I don't have here, like I said, is Fooled by Randomness. And Fooled by Randomness is probably the underlying piece. And so in that book, he talks about the fact that as human beings, we have the habit of effectively, specifically when random things happen, creating narratives afterwards, which reduces our understanding of how much randomness is in the event. So okay. It's not that all things are random, it's just that we underestimate how much randomness there necessarily is. And there's various reasons for that. My learnings from that has been, and I think also, you know, part of my career has been involved in investments, both managing portfolios and selecting appropriate investments for clients, etc. But for me, it's this piece around there is so much uncertainty in our world, and there is a certain element we can control and there's a certain element we can't control. And I think you can go nuts trying to control the outcomes. I think what we can do is we can control the process.
Okay.
So in the context of us underestimating how much randomness and uncertainty it is, the takeaway for me is focus on controlling the process. And some of the best investors, I'm obsessed also with investment, etc., and the thinking there of some of the greatest investors over time. Often it's about having a good process. There is always uncertainty. You can't control the outcome. That's the nature of probabilities. You know, 50% you're going to be right, 50% you're going to be wrong. That's not the important thing, is that was your process good in getting to the actions that you took? And in our world, it's the law of large numbers. If you've got a good process, the law of large numbers comes into play, and over time you will get the outcome that you expect. But the process is so important. So that's been the big learning for me from that. And hopefully allows you to sleep better at night when you realize that you can't control the outcome. You can position yourself as best as possible, but you can't control the outcome often.
What would the process be? Would it be, you know, investment mandates and rules and what you
know, do? I mean, often it's around, and it's around discipline. It's around, and one of the other books which we'll talk about a little bit later from Michael Lewis is The Undoing Project, which I'll get to a little bit, which was, you know, maybe the birth of sort of behavioral finance, etc. But it is about having a disciplined process that avoids effectively systematic errors. So, you know, sticking to your process. Your process can only work over time if you apply a consistent process. If you keep changing the way you do things, or if you keep changing your process, obviously you can tinker and it can improve over time. But if you make material changes, then your outcome over time is definitely not going to be what you want and you expect. So for me, discipline, I think, is the most important piece in terms of process.
Do you have a favorite quote or, you know, idea from this book that you'd like to...
Yeah, so I don't have a specific quote. So also out of the four books, I think probably The Black Swan and Anti-Fragile was the most interesting for me.
Okay.
So the idea in Anti-Fragile, they talk about systems, let's call it for example's sake, that can be either fragile. So when they're exposed to some kind of shock, they fall apart. Mm-hmm. They can be robust. They're exposed to some kind of shock, they're stable. And then anti-fragile, which is, I think, Taleb... creates this phrase, which is they actually get stronger. And the interesting thing is that as much as that feels like quite a weird concept, it actually occurs in everyday life. If you exercise, you're exposing your body to small stresses that hopefully make you stronger and more, you know, more robust. If you think about nature, it's the exact same thing. It's effectively, you know, things improve by having small stresses. So he talks quite actively in here around, or extensively, the idea that really stood out for me is this piece around being exposed to small, manageable stresses is actually very good because it makes us stronger. And often you find in many kind of environments, we try get rid of, especially in our world, you try get rid of all of the stresses. We don't want to make mistakes, whether they're big or small. Mm. And in actual fact, it's only by making small mistakes that you avoid the big mistakes.
Okay.
And we want to get rid of any kind of volatility. But all you do is you just create more unstable situations and environments, or whether it's for clients' portfolios or whatever it may be. So it's this idea of having some kind of volatility, having some kind of being exposed to some kind of small stresses in actual fact, really positive, because that's actually how you evolve. You get better, you get stronger, you improve, it stretch, etc. Yeah, I mean, it's a very common, well-known idea. It's just the way he positioned it, I actually quite in.
Do you reread books as a rule?
I do. So, and maybe that's also an idea from Nassim Taleb. So in the last book, Skin in the Game, he talks about this idea of, as an example, so he talks about books and he talks about, you know, brand new books that have just come out. They haven't been battle tested yet. Like, people haven't read them, haven't determined if they're good, if they're not good. So if you've got a limited amount of time, should you be reading books that are 70 years old and are still effectively well-regarded because they've been battle-tested, or ones that are brand new? And that was quite interesting for me because I was very much the kind of person that walked into exclusive books, looked at the brand new book stand, and, you know, picked what's interesting from there. And so maybe a bit of that is what's, you know, recently skewed me to, especially even on the fiction side, you know, reading the kind of books that have been around for the last 70, 100 years and are still well-regarded. So from a book's perspective, that's just an interesting idea that just fortuitously came from one of these.
With books, I guess in a similar vein, are you someone who will go to the same restaurant because you know it's good rather than risk going to a new restaurant that won't be good? Or like a new travel destination versus one that you know
is good? I'm very much a creature of habit.
Okay.
No, I'm very much a creature of habit. And especially if I find something I like, look, you know, after a while, you know, you want something different, but I typically will stick with something I like for an extended period of time. I fit into that camp.
Well, I guess, you know, a few years ago, I heard, it's so obvious, but you only have so many years of life and there are only so many books you can read. So, and that applies to everything, you know, so I guess that kind of fits into the idea of making sure that the things you do spend your time on are going to give you the best value.
Yeah, I suppose it's always around like to that exact point. Like, should you be reading the same book five times?
Yeah, exactly.
If, you know, you've only got so much time. I suppose the one caveat for me is I think the kind of books that I've read multiple times are the kind of ones where every time I read it, I get something else new out of it. You know, I suppose if when it comes to movies, I have a bad habit of watching the same movie multiple times. I've watched some movies like 15, 20 times, and that's pure just entertainment.
Yeah.
But when it comes to books, the ones that I do read again, typically it's because every time I read them, there's something else I get out of them. It's not necessarily that you learn something, but you get something new out of it. So hopefully that's a balance in terms of what you were saying, in terms of how much time we've got to read. Although if we live to 100, there's a lot of time to read.
Yeah, especially if we have good health span as well.
Exactly.
Have all
exactly.
our faculties. What's the next book we're going to talk about?
I'm trying to think if we must go intense again or a bit more relaxed. So maybe let's become a little bit more relaxed. So I don't have the books with me, but I'm a big Michael Lewis fan.
Okay.
And particularly Big Short, which was made into a movie. And
yes.
For many people, it was a great movie. The Undoing Project was not made into a movie. So the Undoing Project, for people that haven't read that, I actually quite enjoyed it. And there's a bit of backstory there. So when I finished my maths PhD at University of Johannesburg, and I was looking at moving into financial service, I knew nothing. And the advice I got was, you need some kind of like exposure to the financial world. Like, go study something, whether it's study accounting or whatever it is. And what I landed on was University of Johannesburg had a brand new course mimicked on the CFA called a Masters of Financial Economics. And in that course, they had one of the modules was about behavioral finance. So it was the first time I got exposed to it and I was hooked. I thought it was fantastic. So the Undoing Project by Michael Lewis is about two Israeli academic scientists, Amos Tversky, Daniel Kahneman, who, you know, like in many regards were, you know, effectively put some of the foundation in place when it comes to behavioral finance. So I really enjoy Michael Lewis, his writing style. He often writes about stuff that has to do with our world, let's call it financial markets, but like on the edges. So it's sort of like those stories that are important, but on the edge. And he often finds, he writes quite extensively about specific characters and often the oddball characters, which I quite enjoy as well. So Undoing Project, I listened to that audiobook. I really enjoyed that. Big Short many times. And then Moneyball is one of my favorites, also as a movie.
What's Moneyball about?
Moneyball, interesting enough, is... So there's one consistency as well. In all of Michael Lewis's movies, there's typically Brad Pitt. because he's in Big Short and he's in Moneyball. So Moneyball is about baseball, but it's about statistics.
Okay.
So I'm guessing that it was in the early 2000s, etc. I mean, so the story is that there was a non-baseball, non-mathematics guy called Bill James, like in the 70s, and he wrote a book about baseball based upon statistics. And like everybody wrote it off, and somehow it ends up, you know, being taken up by the main character, who's a general manager of one of the big baseball franchises in the US, and it actually works. like actually they roll it out and it actually works. And it's based on you know, this idea that player selection, etc., was, you know, a lot of gut feel, a lot of expertise. I mean, they make it in the movie, they make it a bit of a joke, and it's in the book as well. You know, they chose players based upon, do they look athletic?
Okay.
You know, are they good looking? You know, versus
reason.
Necessarily are they, if you looked at the hard numbers and the stats, like what does their performance say versus the impressions we get? So I'm going to jump back to Nassim Taleb. He talks about, you know, also in one of his books, I can't remember which one, similar kind of thing. You know, you want to go to a doctor who doesn't look like a doctor. Because if they're still in business and they've got a terrible bedside manner and they look disheveled and they don't look like a doctor, they must be really good at their speciality. Or, you know, you want to go to a dentist with really bad teeth because, you know, if they're still in business and they don't look the part, they must be good. So it's the same thing. Yeah, it's around. And baseball was just an example, but it was this piece around how people made decisions not based upon the facts, but based upon these impressions that built up over time. And some of them, in actual fact, when you think about it, you go like, that makes absolutely no sense. But it was done for hundreds of years and it was so obvious. So that's Moneyball. It's a movie well worth watching. It's well put together. Even if you know nothing or care nothing about baseball, I'm not a particularly big fan. No, me neither. But I really enjoyed that. And then The Big Short was interesting because in my early days in my banking career at Investec, I was probably there, you know, 2008, 2009 happened. I was, you know, 2 years in.
Wow.
The area that I was in and we were starting something brand new was very much related to, you know, effectively what brought down the financial system. So structured credit and all that kind of stuff. So that I sort of lived through it, albeit that we lived through it by observing from the outside. So there was a link back a bit to the early days of my career in that in the movie, which was always interesting as well. I was quite close to sort of seeing how it was playing out in real time, even though we were purely observers.
Can you tell me about your early life? I'm so interested in how you know, PhD in mathematics is not a common thing, and then, you know, transition to from academia to, you know, as corporate as you can get. So yeah, what were the different kind of motivations at different stages of your life?
Yeah, so I had a very simple upbringing. I grew up in Johannesburg. I grew up in the Vale, in Edenvale, okay. Which for someone that's in Johannesburg,
you'll
I don't
understand.
Know what that means.
Okay.
But you know, normal, went to a government school, more focused on sport than necessarily on academia. Applied my mind a little bit more to schooling near the end of it because you were now going to university. You know, there were bursaries you could get, etc. So I ended up at RAU. It was actually RAU at that stage.
Right.
It only became UJ later on in my academic career. And there's no actual, there was no profound reason why I started with mathematics. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I went into those aptitude tests, which you can take with a pinch of salt. And they said, you have an affinity and an aptitude for science. Why don't you do a science degree? So I picked whatever was the most general. I did maths, applied maths, and I did physics. And I actually didn't know that I was going to continue with mathematics. I got to third year. My third year physics lecturer didn't see necessarily eye to eye. And so after a couple of months, I decided to stop with the physics. And so I was left with maths and applied maths. I had a bit of a midlife crisis, went and chatted to the head of the maths department. And she said, well, you've got some extra time. Why don't you go? They need what she thought was a tutor at a school in Johannesburg called Roosevelt High School, just down the road from RAU. It turned out they wanted a full-time maths teacher. So my third year, I actually went and taught maths to, in those days, standard sixes, eights, and matrix.
Okay.
I had to try and make myself look a little older than I was at 19. But I taught maths, and I loved the teaching piece. So what came out of that purely by chance ending up there was I actually loved the teaching piece. So the content was interesting. But the actual teaching was stuff that I really enjoyed. And somewhere in my mind, I got the idea that I wanted to get a PhD, not for any particular reason. It just seemed like that was the path.
Okay.
And I studied honors. And then after honors, I actually then became a full-time maths lecturer in the maths department while I finished my master's and my PhD. And I loved the lecturing, which is very strange for academics. Most academics, they do the lecturing because they get paid to do that, but they actually want to, you know, sit in the office and do whatever it is that they're doing from a
which
content
means that
thing.
They're not the best teachers.
Not necessarily. They're not the most enthusiastic teachers. And I did pure math. So also, I just must clarify, it's not, I didn't do statistics. I did, you know, the stuff that becomes quite abstract quite quickly.
No numbers involved.
No numbers at all. I mean, people ask me what my PhD is on, and it's like I had to go look it up. But the interesting thing in retrospect is I got very little content out of my 7 or 8 years of studies from a maths perspective. But the skills you develop in basically having to think in a very systematic, logical way, understand what are the facts you can work with, what do you want to get to, how do you get there, like those skills were invaluable. When I was actually at Roosevelt High, the head of our maths department was, we're going to go on a tangent here. There was a show back in the 90s called Noot for Noot. Okay.
Oh my gosh. Do you have a connection?
There you go. So Noot for Noot. And the presenter was
Johan Stemmert.
Johan Stemmert. Johan Stemmert's wife was the head of our maths department at Roosevelt High.
Oh my word.
And she had this, which I've remembered to this day, this fantastic analogy. She used to say every time someone in one of the maths classes says to her, "Why am I learning about quadratic equations? How is this going to help me in life?" She says, "Look at the rugby players over there. They're doing push-ups. Tell me where in the rugby match they're going to do a push-up. They're conditioning themselves." And like that just stuck with me. And it's not intentional, but if I actually think about what was my academic career about, it was that. I learned skills. I got some kind of conditioning, which I think has been useful. Content-wise, no idea. I can't remember what I did.
I love that analogy.
It's fantastic. It stuck with me, and everybody out there. And again, I must give credit to Mafro Stemmert.
So, did you ever get to meet Johan, most importantly?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I can see that, like, you were hoping for a connection there. Like, can I give them a call and get them on the podcast? And then somewhere in that process, I said, okay, I have an academic career, which is going to involve me teaching. Loved it. But there's expectations to sit in your office and come up with, you know, new research. And there was a realization that when I finished my PhD, there were probably three people in the world that understood my PhD. And that's because those are the only three that cared, not because there was only three that could. And so the other alternative at that stage, I mean, this was like this was early 2000s. There was a big, you know, for people that had some kind of analytical background, there was a big drive in terms of financial institutions saying, hold on, come, there could be opportunities. And, you know, that was the case with actuaries. That was obvious because you're trained to go into there. But, you know, people with a maths background or a physics background, that was sort of the time where there was opportunity. So I ended up getting an opportunity at Investec from Stephen. He, fascinating character. It was one of the privileges of my career to work with him over the years. But I did realize, and the advice I got is that there's a bit of a gap. If you want to go into the financial services, why not study something? And that's how I ended up also doing the master's in financial economics, which was fascinating. So there was no profound shift. It was just a matter of my paths are academia. My path is financial services. Let's go check it out. I'll do 2 or 3 years, see what it's all about. Probably not what I want to do. I still sort of did a bit of lecturing during that time. I lectured actually afterwards to some of the masters in financial economics guys, and then it's just stuck, and I've been there ever since.
What's the next book we're going to talk about?
Okay, so I think we'll go deep, but this is a quick one. So this is a book that I've also read multiple times.
It's so tiny.
It is tiny. It's 100 pages.
Gosh.
It was written also in the 50s. It's called The Lessons of History by Will and Ariel Durant, who, as I understand, were historians. I haven't done the back research on this, but I just want to check exactly. It was written originally in 1968. And basically it covers off very simple, like it's quite in-depth. I'll read some quotes and it's like pretty intense, but which is why 100 pages is enough. But it talks about like history of economics, history of religion, history of biology, race, character, government, etc. So I do have a quote. I'm going to preempt you even having to ask. And like I said, it's a little intense, but I found it quite interesting. So this is on the section of biology and history. So they say that, so the first biological lesson of history is that life is competition. Competition is not only the life of trade, it's the trade of life. Peaceful when food abounds, violent when mouths outrun the food. Animals eat one another without qualms. Civilized men consume one another by due process of law. Cooperation is real and increases with social development, but mostly because it is a tool and form of competition. We cooperate in our group, our family, community, club, church, party, race, or nation in order to strengthen our group in its competition with other groups. Don't ask me what I take out of that. I just found it fascinating. And so this book for me is interesting because, like, yes, it's hard reading, but I think, like, there is so much truth when you think about this. And the fascinating thing is that this was written 50, 60 years ago.
So it kind of condenses all truth into these.
Well, you know, these pages. Are just the lessons of history. That's really, really what it was. And then the other one, that's also very interesting, and it's on the next page. It says that utopias of equality are biologically doomed. And the best that the amiable philosopher can hope for is an approximate equality of legal justice and educational opportunity. And that's very interesting. I mean, especially in a country such as our own. Well, it's not even a South African thing. It's globally, equality is everywhere. And I think, you know, we really battle with how do you manage that. And what was fascinating here is that saying that, like, as a minimum, you got to have equality from a legal justice perspective and an educational perspective. There are so many other things that, you know, equality just won't, especially in a capitalist growth type, you know, societies we live in. It's so hard to achieve, but you've got to get those two right. And I'm a big believer that education is, especially in the context of South Africa, is so important.
So equal opportunity, not necessarily equal outcome, right?
Most definitely. So anyway, so this is, I'm never going to do it justice. This is well worth reading. There's a lot of, and it did win the Pulitzer Prize at some point in time, but it's only 100 pages, but it's also one that I'll open up at a random chapter. It's like each chapter is 5 pages.
What would you say is your the period of history that you find most fascinating?
So I'm not a big history person in the traditional sense. I mean, the only history I've really done is the history I did at school. I'm very interested in, like, sort of more themes. And I think this book is like it. I'm more interested in the themes that have been consistent through time rather than specific to an individual time. I'm a big believer that, yeah, there are certain consistencies that may play out in slightly different ways, but, you know, there is some element of, you know, they always say it's like a common thing. It's, you know, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And I mean, we always think about it in the context of financial markets, but it extends through everything. So I don't have a specific period that interests me the most, but I think just getting exposure to some of those themes that just seem to repeat themselves in different shapes or forms, but there's an element of continuity, that for me is fascinating. And that's really what this book is all about.
What about themes in terms of human nature and behavior?
Sure. So, and that's exactly it. Some of the things that are just inherent to us being human, or inherent to work, living in communities, in society, civilization, whatever it may be. Oh, sorry, it got intense very quickly again. we're going to have to take it down a little bit.
All right. What's the next book?
Okay. So this is also, again, more of an author. So I brought one of his specific books. It's Bill Bryson. So and most people have had some kind of exposure to Bill Bryson. I think there's the theory of, or not theory, the history of everything or whatever it's called. This is my most, the one I enjoyed the most. It's called The Body. So basically, it's all about the human body. It covers off all aspects of the human body, but he writes in a very humorous, entertaining, easy to understand way, but you still learn. So I'm not a expert on, you know, anything medical related necessarily. So this has been very interesting. But I do have a quote, and the quote is literally like on the 4th page. So interesting enough, so he starts the book by talking about, he just talks a little bit about some of the projects that have ran over the last whatever number of years where people have looked, where scientists have looked at the elements that make up the human body.
Okay.
And then they've tried to price it. So they've said, well, how much would a human body cost to replicate just based upon the quantity of different elements that are in our body?
Okay.
So it's a bit tongue-in-cheek. But he finishes the specific section that by saying, that is unquestionably the most astounding thing about us, that we are just a collection of inert components, the same stuff you would find in a pile of dirt. That's a bit dark. I've said it before in another book. It does turn, don't worry. I've said it before in another book, but I believe it's worth repeating. The only thing special about the elements that make you is that they make you. This is the miracle of life. And that for me is fascinating, because it is actually that, like, I've been reading this book again. I'm on the section about the human brain, and he talks about the fact that the human brain is this, like, tofu consistent you know, 2 to 3 kilogram mass sitting in your head, and it's basically water. And yet, if you think about what it can achieve and what it does, just the computing power in the brain, when you compare it to like some of the most sophisticated, you know, computers we have in place at the moment, in terms of storage or in terms of computational capacity, it's just, there is nothing comparable. But when you actually go and break it down or look at it, if you're an alien, okay, not that I necessarily believe in aliens, but if you came from another world and you came and you looked at this human brain, it would look like nothing to you. Yet what it actually can do is amazing. And like, we don't understand that. Like, we don't understand, we understand how these things practically work, but like, how did these inert elements become effectively what is us, and achieve what different parts of us are able to achieve? That's fascinating.
So with this kind of book, do you enjoy the subject matter, or is it more his writing style that captures you?
A bit of both. So, you know, you learn a lot. Like, every time I read it, I learn something new. I find the content very interesting, but I think his writing style I enjoy. I think if it was written in a different way, like a reference book, like a traditional reference book, like, I probably wouldn't last past the past. I wouldn't even get to the fourth page. But I think his writing style just makes it a whole lot more accessible. It's the kind of book like you can read before you go to bed, because of his writing style.
And then feel like you've actually learned something.
So. You learn something. It's entertaining. I mean, you can get different things out of it. I find I quite enjoy, like, we spoke earlier about content versus writing style. Like, the right writing style means that you can just enjoy it in very different situations, versus some books are very interesting, but man, they're hard to read. And then you need to be in a very specific frame of mind, in a very specific situation, in order to necessarily get what you want out of it. But a good author, you know, can create something, or can take content and make it super accessible. And then, you know, I gravitate towards.
Okay, what's the last book? And then we can do an honorable mention or two.
Yeah, so the last book is actually it's a fiction book, but it's borderline. So it's called Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. It's a bit of I mean, we won't get into the story necessarily. It was written, again, I think in the 50s or 60s. And there's a few books that she's got. This specific one was, my cousin actually said, start with this one.
Okay.
At that point in time, he felt like there were elements of the story or the message that sort of was tied to where South Africa was six months ago. I think there's a lot of positivity, obviously, since the most recent elections, but there was a period of time that everybody will acknowledge where, you know, SA was in a darker place.
So you read this recently?
I've read this recently, yeah. Look, okay. It's 1,000 pages, over 1,000 pages. So it took me a little bit of time reading it at night before going to bed, but I did read it recently.
What's the plot?
So, I mean, I won't get into the character specifically. The underlying message is, so it's set in the US. I'm not too sure even when, but, you know, some of it's quite futuristic, but most of it is still in the days of like railroads and all that kind of stuff. So the main character is a lady who's the COO of one of the oldest railroad companies. And basically the story is that where they find themselves in the US at this point in time is that you've got I'm out of my depth of expertise here, but you've got a government that has got very strong sort of socialists, in not a positive way, a negative socialist type tendencies, enormous amount of like very extractive, let's put it that way. So they take a lot, and the country's actually being kept afloat by a very small group of what they call producers. So let's call it innovators. In this case, it's business people. So they, you know, Ayn Rand was very big around the importance of business and business people, but let's call it innovators, etc. And so you've got a few innovators who are literally keeping the country going, and you've got a very much a government and a big part of the population that are extractors. So if you think about it in the context of South Africa, you think about corruption and you think about that piece. And the big the thing for me is interesting was throughout the book, the big tension, and I got a quote which will talk a little bit, which will talk to this. The big debate is around some of the producers have a view that they must continue to push, they must continue to invent, they must continue to innovate, they must continue to work really hard, because that's actually how you stand up to effectively the takers. And others are, well, in actual fact, if you do that, you actually just playing into their hands, because the only reason they can take is because you're producing. So there's this battle throughout the 1,000 pages between these producers that sit on either sides of the spectrum. One are like, we must stop producing, and then effectively the system will collapse and we can rebuild. And the others are, we must keep producing, okay, pushing, because ethically that's the right thing to do. And so that for me was, it was an interesting book. Again, the writing style, 1,000 pages, the writing style has to be good. And because it was written 50, 60 years ago, I think it's there's also nuances that I find quite interesting. So I do have a quote, and the quote in actual fact is, it feels like the obvious quote, but it's not. And it's actually where the name of the book came from. So two of the main characters, who are both producers, the one guy's called Francisco and the other guy's called Hank Reardon, and they're talking and they're having this debate. And basically Francisco says, Mr. Reardon, his voice solemnly calm, if you saw Atlas, the giant who holds the world on his shoulders, if you saw that he stood, blood running down his chest, his knees buckling, his arms trembling, but still trying to hold the world aloft with the last of his strength, and the greater his effort, the heavier the world bore down upon his shoulders, what would you tell him to do? And Hank Reardon says, I don't know. What could he do? What would you tell him? And he says, to shrug. And that's the debate that they're having around, if we're this group of people holding up the world, and I mean, it's a bit melodramatic, but if you're holding up the world, like, what do you do? Do you keep holding it up until you can't anymore? Or in his case, you shrug. Wow. So that for me, I thought was I quite liked that quote. I mean, it's how many pages in, because you don't know why the book is called Atlas Shrugged until page 455.
So I'm guessing the outcome is that they did stop producing.
They do at the end, they sort of stop producing.
Boy,
they disappear and the system collapses, and then they rebuild it all together. But the big debate through the whole thing is how, this fight between, and how that plays out.
Okay. And I see we have one interesting looking book there, which deserves mention.
I will grab this over here. So this is not a reading book. This is called James Hoffman's the World Atlas of Coffee, and he's actually British, so I don't think it's Hoffman, but anyway, James Hoffman. So I mean, a lot of people would have probably seen his stuff. So he's a coffee guy. He's like all over social media. He has YouTube videos, etc. He was one of the world barista champs like 10, 15 years ago. I really enjoy my coffee. I only started, strangely enough, when I was lecturing. So the first time I ever had coffee, I was like 22 or 23 years old. And embarrassing to say, especially because I now live in Cape Town, is that it actually was one of those like cappuccinos that comes in a sachet. You know, where you mix.
I don't judge.
Okay, where you mix. It's basically instant coffee plus like synthetic froth, and I thought that was amazing for ages. So again, I don't know if it was when I moved to Cape Town 12, 13 years ago that I became a bit of a coffee snob. The guys in Johannesburg always joke when they come here and say, like, where do we get a good bean? That's what you ask a Cape Townian.
So what would your answer be to that question?
Interesting enough, since I started watching a lot of his stuff and reading his books, I actually quite enjoy making my coffee at home.
Okay.
And I found I was drinking an enormous amount of coffee with milk, because in South Africa, like, fancy coffee comes with milk. It's either a flat white or cortado or something along those lines. But I'm really enjoying just making coffee like old school through a filter and drinking without milk. So that's now like my highlight in the morning is I've got a little Chemex and I make my coffee and I grind my beans and I try things out. So the nice thing is that like he's very much about, when it comes to coffee, is just trying new things, like tinkering around, like your little like science lab, and you get to enjoy a good coffee at the end of it. So yeah, I don't know if that makes me a coffee snob or just a coffee experimenter, but I brought this with because I thought it was quite fun.
Pictures in?
It's got, yeah, so he covers off everything from like,
oh, wow,
how does processing work, and what are the different brewing basics, from espressos to, the kind of things that you can get at home, where the different, the different growing regions, etc. So I haven't read it cover to cover. I've read bits and pieces.
Yeah.
He's also got another one, which is about specifically brewing at home. This is more of a reference book for me, but it's like a little bit of a science experiment.
It's such a nice hobby. I wish I liked coffee. I don't, because I think it's such a nice culture, and smells so good, and there's this whole, you know, aura or ritual around it, which is so nice.
So,
and lots of like-minded people as well, so it's, you know, a connection to other people.
Agreed. And we're, I mean, we've got such great coffee in Cape Town. We're spoiled here. So
in this, you know,
in this specific in the specific area, yeah. So that I thought I'd bring with for fun. It wasn't. I don't have a quote, but
that's fine. Okay. So the books we spoke about, and remind me if I've left any out, were Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, Fooled by Randomness, and the whole series by Nassim Nicholas Taleb. The Lessons of History by Will and Ariel Durant, The Body by Bill Bryson, Michael Lewis's books, The Big Short, The Undoing Project, Moneyball, The 100-Year Life by Linda Grattan and Andrew Scott, I believe. And then
correct.
The World Atlas of Coffee.
Which was a last-minute addition by James Hoffman.
Still made it in. So if I had to be very cruel and send you to a desert island with only one of these books, which one would it be?
I think it would be one of two. It would either be The Lessons of History, although that is quite intense, or it would be one of the Nassim Taleb books. Like I said, I've read those multiple times, and every time I find something new to learn or to think about. So it would definitely be one of those. I really enjoy the ideas in the others, but you know, some of the others I wouldn't necessarily read more than once.
Okay, and I guess in that case you'd have to be happy with something you could read, or you'd have to choose something that you could read multiple times.
Although, again, I mean, if we go into an island, I should probably pick the biggest one. I can make a fire out of it. But I don't know if that was the point.
And what are you currently reading?
So I'm actually reading The Body again by Bill Bryson.
Okay.
I'm trying to stick to one at a time because I've got less time these days for reading. I'm trying to do one at a time. I did also go through a period where I'd have like four books next to my bed and I would be in various stages of reading them. Yeah. But like I've tried to focus a little bit. So I'm reading The Body by Bill Bryson again.
Okay. I feel like that's also, you know, either you're someone who reads multiple books at a time or you read one book at a time.
I just don't think I'll finish if I read four at a time because I don't have an enormous amount of time at the moment. But I had no problem reading multiple books. Like some people really battle with it. I don't think I'd read necessarily four fiction books at the same time. That would be very weird. But nonfiction,
weird
I think. Yeah, nonfiction, I think, is much easier. So I would. I'm trying to stick to one just so that I actually get through it in some reasonable period of time.
And perhaps last question combined, you know, firstly, what is next for Investec Life? And then where can people get hold of you if they want to reach out or follow what you're up to?
Shucks. Okay. So the second one is easy. You can't. Okay. I'm not very good. I occasionally consume social media. I'm not very active as a producer on social media. So unfortunately,
we can follow Investec's.
I'm a bit under the radar, media. But yeah, if you follow Investec, I mean, we in the context of now having the full proposition, you know, for our private clients and our high income clients, we're trying to produce a lot of content, you know, that's hopefully positive and useful to them. So I'll be behind some of that. And then for Investec Life, you know, we spent the last 7 years really focusing on the Investec private clients and the high income clients in our private bank. What we do understand is that there are clients that may not bank with Investec, you know, that are still, you know, private clients in nature that we think that we've got some really interesting solutions for and that we've got a very interesting proposition for. So we're spending some time now, you know, going outside of just necessarily our private banking base with various partners. So some of those clients would be clients of other parts of Investec. They may be business owners or entrepreneurs that deal with us from a business banking perspective. It could be clients in our wealth management business that don't necessarily work with our bank. So that's the big focus for us at the moment on the risk side. We also have a really nice investments business that's a little bit more niche and it's growing nicely. I think we're solving some interesting problems for clients, and we spoke earlier about how you bring the risk and the investments piece together. That's hopefully on our radar as well for the next little while.
And looking forward to following that and hopefully being part of that. I have a gift for you to say thank you for being on the podcast, and it's naturally a book, and I feel like it has to be something I've read and enjoyed, even though it may not be for you. So this is actually the last book I read. I finished it, I think, last week. It's called Trust by Hernan Diaz. Won the Booker Prize in 2022. And why I think you may enjoy it, even though you're not, you know,
It won the Pulitzer Prize as well in 23.
Oh, well, there you go.
Gee.
Maybe it was a Booker Prize shortlist.
No,
but
both.
Okay. So what's nice about it is that it's structured in a very interesting way, in that there's, you know, a novel within a novel, and then, you know, different points of view about what actually happened. But it's about a financier from, you know, the early 1900s in New York, and goes into quite a bit of detail about how he made his money with, you know, derivatives and then market crash and all that. So hopefully, yeah, hopefully you'll get around to it.
I haven't seen this before, but I mean, if it's Pulitzer Prize and Booker Prize, it's, and if it comes with a good recommendation, then I'm interested.
Thanks, Darren. It's been such a pleasure.
Perfect.